Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and I'm so pleased to see on my screen this morning Shireen Gourbani on the left. Good morning, Shireen.
Good morning. We're adding a Zoom element. It's very fun.
And on the political right, Dan McKay.
Hey, good morning, everybody. It's good to see you again.
You know, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the coronavirus today, but I think it's worth noting a few things. We have, 414,000 deaths globally, about 114,000 deaths in the U.S., and in our own state, 127,000 deaths. This is truly a global pandemic of epic proportions for our country. And in our state, we're hanging in there, Shireen.
We're hanging in there, but we're not seeing great numbers these past few weeks. We had a conversation at the county council with Gary Edwards, the health director for the Salt Lake County Health Department, and he said something that really sounded true to me. I think people are experiencing kind of a fatigue. They're just tired of social distancing. They're tired of not gathering in groups. We're seeing fewer people wearing masks, and we are seeing our numbers surge. And it's one of, a handful of states. I think I read this morning there are about a dozen states that are moving in the wrong direction. And I'm sad to say that we're one of them.
Yeah, Dan, I worry that the state strategy has not been well enough articulated. And I'd love to hear your comments there, but in the urgent phase of the pandemic, the strategy was to flatten the curve. It provided time so the state could procure needed medical supplies, build testing capacity, operationalize the response. But we largely accomplished those objectives, and then the state moved to a strategy to safely reactivate the economy while protecting high-risk populations, and it was always expected that we would have rising case counts, but that our deaths would stay in control. So, Dan, I'd love to hear if that's the way you understand the state strategy as a state senator.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Natalie. You look at the flatten the curve was a very easy message, and everybody understood it. And I think the basic principles for how we're going to accomplish it were readily available, right? Stay home, distance, do those kinds of things. However, safely opening is a much more complicated story, and I think it's much more complicated for people to really kind of understand, like, what to do, what not to do. Should I, can I have a bunch of family over? Can I tip this police car over? What can I do safely during this reactivation? And I think there's also some frustration as well, Natalie. Like, If you lock people up, as much as, I don't say lock people up, but if people are isolated as much as they are, I think emotions are different. I think the frustrations are different. And so everybody's kind of coming out of this in a different place. And I'm not sure that from a mental health standpoint that everybody's walking out of it from a healthy mental health standpoint. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
it does.
I think we also continue to struggle, unfortunately, with a president who has politicized this in ways that are really out of sync with what we're seeing even in our own state. I think that we see many states across this nation, red, blue, whatever, saying, wear the masks, keep up the social distancing, take care of your neighbors in this really in these really simple and respectful ways. And then we have some chaos happening at the top, and it's hard. I think it's hard for people at all levels of government to navigate when that's happening.
Shireen, let's jump on that for a second. James Mattis is someone that we all respect. He said, characterize our president as a threat to the Constitution. The thing that was most quoted about his most recent comments was him saying that he was the first president in Mattis's lifetime who does not try to unite the American people. I'll go to Dan first and then to you, Shireen, but Dan, he speaks truth there. I mean, this guy is not a uniter.
Yeah, President Trump knows his base, and he knows his base well, and he tends to, from a political messaging standpoint, he tends to grab his base and make sure that they understand where he is and confirm some of their feelings or those kinds of things. And it is, I would say, I think it'd be easy for everyone to blame it on the president that he's not a uniter. But I will also say there's also this bias against everything the president says. And it's an overwhelming number of people that just don't want to hear what he has to say. And even when they listen to him, it's not because they're listening to him to, like, you know, figure out how the country can be better. They're listening because they're running immediately to social media with a soundbite about how horrible the president is and why he's to blame for everything that's going wrong at the moment in the country. And so in that way, I think this president, for one reason or another, he is more divisive, not only in how he speaks, but I think how the public receives him is more divisive. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. I will say this, and America, you have to know this, and Salt Lake, Utah, we have to know this. This is not the first divisive president we've had. I mean, if you go through and look and listen to history, you know, the presidents throughout history have been extremely divisive. And this is just the one that has the most social media going on. And so people are aware of it. Does that make sense?
It does. You know how, I won't get the number right, but they always say that a huge portion of your communication is your body language. And in the sort of quarantine, we don't get to see body language like we do. But Shireen, I'm seeing your body language this morning as Dan apologizes for this president. She's smiling at me. But I'd love to hear your comment about Mattis's, you know, uniter, divider comments about this president. And if you want to respond to what Dan said.
Yeah, this is, I mean, truly, I think what Mattis is saying here couldn't be more obvious to your average citizen in this country. What I think is so devastating about it is that I think you can have, you know, deeply entrenched political ideologies. You can have, you know, negative feelings about the other party. And I think when you step into an office, like actually any elected office, but when you are standing there, I think it's really important to drop some of that and to really think about how you're going to get good work done on behalf of the people that you represent. And I do have a lot of criticisms about our, you know, supermajority control in this state. But what I also know is that a lot of really important conversations happen across party lines all the time. I just don't see this president as somebody who's actually interested in bringing together our best and brightest, especially in this moment. There's a large public perception that his response on coronavirus has been flawed from the beginning. You may remember the numerous days that he spent telling American people that this was not going to be that big of a deal, really did not prepare us in the way that we needed to be prepared for the kind of loss of life and just the kind of precautions that we need to be taking now. He wasn't prepared for that. He certainly is not prepared to respond to the hard and difficult conversations we're having about entrenched white supremacy at this moment in our country, especially when he has Stephen Miller by his side, who is a person who holds many of these very dangerous ideologies around white supremacy. So there's so much to unpack here, but I think what I'm seeing that I'm hopeful for is that many Americans are saying, we need someone who can bring us a sense of calm, a sense of leadership, a sense of hope. And I know that they're looking for that at all levels of government. So I think it's actually a real opportunity for people to step up. We've got a number of candidates running right now, thinking about people who would like to sit in the highest office in this state, people who are looking, you know, running for county seats, who are running for school boards. There are so many opportunities for us to elevate leaders who are going to bring people together in a way that we need now more than ever.
Mm-hmm. We continue to Dan.
I'm just going to say this. I totally disagree in some ways and agree in like a couple. The problem
agree more, it feels
is
good.
Everybody is running to their corners constantly on everything. I want to go back. I saw the most interesting thing. Everybody wanted a gentleman to run, you know, the White House and that kind of thing. And so we got George W. Bush to do it. And the Democrats hated him. It was a deep loathing, right? And then if you shift gears, we tried to get John McCain to get elected, a statesman, very effective U.S. senator. And the Democrats hated him, vilified him, turned him into a mess, right? And then we tried to get like the nicest guy in the entire freaking world, Mitt Romney. And then what did the Democrats do? They totally vilified him. And now that we've hired somebody who's ready to call them on all their crap, now they're really, really upset. It doesn't matter, Natalie. They have to acknowledge all of their talk about bipartisanship is BS, because I will tell you, it doesn't matter who it is. As long as they have an R by their name, the Democrats are going to hate them and they're not going to want to unite. It doesn't matter who it is.
Dan, so I just have to say from the political middle that's the kettle calling it black. You know, I mean, it's goes both ways, for goodness sakes.
No.
We need to go to our next segment after a short break. But I'll just mention that in our next segment, we'll start by talking about the local and national uprising against police violence and anti-black racism. So stay tuned, everyone. Thank you.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We need to talk about these protests, everyone. And the way I thought we'd do it is both to, Dan, we didn't get to hear your voice last week, but just your general reaction from the right on what we see happening in our country. And then if you'd comment on Senator Mitt Romney joining the Black Lives Matter march in Washington, D.C. over the past week. He marched with a faith-based demonstration, and he was actually quoted as saying, "We need a voice against racism. We need many voices against racism and against brutality. And we need to stand up and say that Black Lives Matter."
So I'm going to say something in the show that I have not said, period. And I wanted to save it for the show to talk about this, right? Because I've been thinking about the issue and probably had a little bit of time to process now that things are, you know, kind of cooling down a little bit. I frankly am very proud of Mitt Romney taking the stance he did. He's right. We need a greater voice against racism in this country. We really do. And, you know, how you attack it, how you deal with it, I think those are broader conversations that we're going to need to be having as a country all the time. Unfortunately, and Natalie, Shireen, you know, Anthony, we all know, I had hoped that by the time my kids are the age they are now, that racism would be like a thing of the past and that it would never be an issue and we would have cured it by now. Clearly we have not. And you know, the interesting thing about this too, about the whole issue is for some reason, people on, you know, in society feel like if you say Black Lives Matter, then you're saying conversely that all the other lives matter less. And I think what the Black members of our community would like to hear instead is that Black lives do matter from a majority or from a minority standpoint. They matter and they just matter. That's okay to say and have it be a thing that exists on its own. And it's okay at the same time to acknowledge your life matters, my life matters, everyone else's lives matter as well. And, not but, and I think it's important that everyone then looks and says, hey, there are things we can do to bring the minority populations in our society up. And there are things that we can do to make lives better. There are things we can do to improve that condition. And what I love about what Mitt Romney said, and I was at first, I was like, man, he is bold. He is taking this amazing, you know, legacy of his father, and then he's joining it, right? And you didn't see him with any security. He had a camera, someone with a phone camera recording him, and that was it. You know, there wasn't a press corps surrounding him. There was none of that stuff. He just wanted to go do this. I admired Mitt's position. You know, I come from a little bit of different background. I'm actually working on a very long, I'm trying to get it down, op-ed, just about, you know, my history of race relations in my life, having grown up in a very poor situation in St. Louis, Missouri. I actually went to school where I was the minority in school. And I think that puts me in a very different position in understanding, you know, my minority friends. And I think it also puts me in a position where I think, man, there are ways in society that we can do this better. And so, but we also have to draw a line. And this is where I regret a little bit, not a little bit, I regret a lot about what happened. You know, we have got to, as a country, we've got to move past the narrative that, you know, that everybody, I don't know how to say this, but we have to move past the narrative that the police are the problem, because I really do believe in a lot of ways that the police are a mirror of us. And so, you know, and how we transition from where we are today to getting past the race element. I'm looking forward to it. I really hope my kids are able to solve it. I think every generation we're getting better at it. Anyways, and everybody knows the rioting's unacceptable and those kinds of things, you know. You get a bunch of people, though, and I mentioned this jokingly earlier in the program, but you get a bunch of people who have emotions from being isolated, from social distancing, and all those other things, and then, you know, everybody just releases all that passion, I guess, out into the streets. Like, I can see it. I can see that frustration. I don't know if that makes sense. So that was too long, but, you know, there we go.
So I have to say that I think you've touched on some really important points. And one of the things that we have to grapple with that I think seems easy conceptually, but we have to deal with it. We're not talking about individual police, especially those that we, you know, maybe know and love in our community. We're talking about the structures of policing. This is the same critique, right? That it's not about individual service members that serve our country in the military. It's about militarization in general, right? And the combination of these issues has been very clear to me as I've been up at the Capitol listening to people from all over the state, a number of young people of color telling their stories and having to do that while Black Hawk helicopters occasionally drown out their voices here, and seeing the way that we've had the National Guard operationalized in our city has been a very difficult side-by-side, right? So we have, we've had some tough moments, really, one of rioting, you know, destruction of property. But we've had night after night, and including this morning, a very peaceful protests. And the way that that's happening with this overshow of force has been deeply disturbing to me and to many in the community.
Shireen and Dan, I want to just speak from the political middle and recommend something to you and to listeners. I follow a guy named David French. He's a conservative thought leader. He writes in the Dispatch, wrote a blog. He has a daughter that he adopted from Ethiopia, and he shared some really interesting comments. And I'm just going to read a quote from his blog that I read. He said, you know, we got to take these steps. He says, it means acknowledging and understanding that the person who is wrong on abortion and health care may be right about police brutality. It means being less outraged at a knee on a football turf than at a knee on a man's neck. And it means declaring that even though we may not agree on everything about race and American life, we can agree on some things, and we can unite where we agree. It's just a really, you know, good comment from the middle, recognizing that you might have a lot of dissimilarities with people, but on this issue, we should be united.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, it's just, there are so many layers to this. And I think we have to reckon with the fact that we have asked police to do really difficult work in many sectors of our community, in schools, the kind of response that happens in the public. And there might be places where a mental health approach, and there are things, good things the state has done to suggest that a mental health approach or a community health approach is a better response than a policing response.
So we've got the defund the police mantra that's out there. This started with me hearing it from my son and just talking about it, but I really realized after I looked deeper that I totally misunderstood the phrase.
Yeah, and what do you take it to mean?
Well, of course, I took it to mean cut their budgets, they're bad people. And it took a little bit of, reading on my part to recognize that what's really being said is invest in people, invest in neighborhoods, invest in, development of human potential. And for that reason, I'll just say that there's a huge part of society that doesn't get the defund the police. And even if those who get it speak it, somehow we've got to get people to understand that it's really about approaching the root causes of our problems. And I think that message is being missed.
Yeah, I think about it really as centering issues, core issues like housing, healthcare, and hunger. If we're addressing some of those key issues, we have the opportunity to maybe shift our thinking about where we ask and how we ask police to correct problems that are already really far down the pipeline of difficulty.
Yeah. Hey, Dan and Shereen, we're getting late in the program, and Dan, you can always just jump in if you want to do something on defund the police. Do you want to say anything there?
I have received a lot of email about the issue from, from folks, not very many in my district, but, the defund the police thing, it is misunderstood. I do think it is time really for us to review the future of policing and how we're going to do things. Just realize, I've always been an advocate for the police to be kind of like the firemen, where instead of patrolling around looking for trouble, they're called to trouble, so to speak. I've always been kind of an advocate, but that's probably that little L libertarian in me that is like, hey, leave me alone. I really don't need help with silly things like stoplights or that kind of stuff. But yeah. By all means, that's going to be an interesting debate going forward for sure.
We have about 3 minutes left in the program, not enough time to do justice to the gubernatorial and other things happening politically. But let's do some quick highlights. We got a poll from the Salt Lake Tribune showing that the governor's race is tighter than we'd thought. Dan, I'd love to hear your thoughts there real quickly, because I want to also talk about the Reyes-Levitt debate.
And it's going to be, I think from a tightening perspective, it is only going to be tighter over the next couple weeks. Realize most people vote within the first week of having their ballot. And I got my ballot yesterday. And so, I'm going to vote today and get it over with and hopefully stop getting save candidates mail costs and that kind of stuff. Because they only mail to people that haven't voted already. So I'm part of the team that way.
Shereen, that same poll showed that 2/3 of the likely voters support Trump, which I thought was good news for Greg Hughes.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
I was going to say, but the other thing we didn't talk about, or we don't have time to, Anthony, we need more showtime, buddy. Okay. So talk to the people, but I'm, one of the things is that, hang on.
Hey, well, Dan,
one of the things that was really interesting was the number of crossover voters. We have almost 40,000 now who have crossed over from either unaffiliated or Democrat and are voting in the Republican primary. That's more than 5% of those voting in the Republican primary. Hey, that's going to be really interesting.
Shereen, I don't know if I'm right about this, but was the Reyes-Levitt AG debate sponsored by the Utah Debate Commission?
It was.
The reason I ask is go to the Utah Debate Commission page, go to the archives, and you can see these debates. That was a fiery debate, and we recommend it to our listeners. Shereen, quick comment?
Yes, I actually watched it last night in anticipation that we would talk about it today. I would highly recommend that people take a strong look at Greg Skordas, who is our nominee for the Democrats, and I'm very proud that he is running the next AG of Utah.
Dan, we are under 2 minutes. Special session, a word to describe what listeners can count on. We're going to get revenue estimates here soon.
Yeah, and obviously, as soon as the budget priorities come out from leadership, this is going to be a knockdown, drag-out issue over the next couple of weeks with everybody concerned about their funding. And so I totally get it, and luckily, we have a lot of people who are trying to work hard to make the state of Utah better.
I'll make a prediction that the revenue numbers are going to be better than some people are thinking. Still tough, but better than they're thinking. We've got time for everyone to give like a one phrase gripe or gratitude. And we'll start with you, Shireen.
My gratitude is for the arts. We're having difficult conversations about budget cuts, and I miss them and I love them.
Dan.
My gratitude is my yard. It looks fantastic right now because I have all this time to work on it.
And I do a gripe. I watched Colin Powell on State of the Union on Sunday. He talked about our president and he said he lies. And I do think words matter. And so I want to see our president move to the truth. Move to the truth. I see you two nodding.
I'm here for that.
I thought Colin Powell said it in a way that we haven't, and you know, two words, he lies.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've been with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, and stay safe.